When we say live from the event, that's exactly what we mean. Our team of experts are at the track, pounding the paddock, patrolling the pits. More driver interviews, more insight, more information, more excitement. As it happens, it's live, it's here, RadioLeMans.com.
So, 13th annual Petit Le Mans at Road Atlanta, and I'm delighted to be doing the latest in the string of Tyler's Long Ones with Doug Feehan, the program manager of Corvette Racing. And Doug, one thing straight off, I love the way that a man in your position is happy to be just known as program manager at a time when everybody else is being a CEO or a COO, or you're more straightforward than that, aren't you?
Well, you know, it's essentially the title that goes with the job, and I'm perfectly happy with that because I'm perfectly happy with my job. And I think I have the advantage of having been here from its inception, so I really inherited nothing from anyone. So the legacy that we've created here has been created as a team. And so that association and that title, I think, is something that has simply stuck around because it delineates who we are as Corvette Racing. It's a group effort.
You've already used the word legacy, and I mean, it's a massive one, isn't it, Corvette Racing?
You know, it's almost scary when I look back. I mean, I talk of things of having just happened, and then someone reminds me that it was 10 years ago when that happened, and that time has absolutely flown by. It's been an amazing adventure for all of us. And I think the thing that makes it even go by more quickly is if you look around, it's the same people that were here a decade ago are still here, and were here a decade before that, which is a testament to the galvanization and the fact that these guys are dedicated to the mission. No one really wants to leave because they see what goes on other places and they realize how good they have it right here. Very few people have come to this program and had the thought that maybe the grass was greener on the other side. It's I think everybody respects what we do, and everyone is valued as a player here. There's a high level of respect for every job category. The guys who drive the truck are treated no differently than the guys who drive the race car. And they all know one another. We were just together last night at a family function at Johnny O'Connell's house as a team. There were almost 40 of us there. Anytime you can create that kind of environment, success is bound to follow.
Now, I've heard you interviewed elsewhere, clearly, and one of the things that you come up with fairly regularly is this business of partnership and the long-term nature of the partnerships that you've created within Corvette Racing. Given that a lot of the team has been around for a long, long time, is there ever an issue about keeping people motivated, or is that already built into the people that you chose?
You know, it's some of the lessons that I have learned throughout my career, one of which is one of the most powerful motivational forces is peer pressure. So you can have bosses come in and threaten your job or threaten your pay or threaten your position, which I've never found to be particularly productive. Or you can create an environment in which people strive to become part of. And once they've achieved that goal of becoming part of a program, the peer pressure that exists in there is all the motivation you need. It's very simply put, and I can only speak directly to our group. No one in this organization wants to be the person to let down the organization. They simply don't. They worked too hard to get here. They've worked too hard while they are here to want to do that. That peer pressure is what is the only thing we need for motivation, and we've done that by establishing ourselves as one of the preeminent road race teams in the world.
So when those things happen, because it's inevitable at some point there is going to be something that goes wrong. Mm-hmm. Somebody lets the side down, whether inadvertently or carelessly or whatever. Let's take Sebring this year as an example. That was so un-Corvette.
That's the perfect example. It's the perfect example. And I want to tell you, that caused us a great deal of personal introspection. And not necessarily from the standpoint of someone making a mistake, which if you looked at it on the surface, you could probably find three or four which you thought would be situations. But if you understood our operational procedures and what we have in place and how perfectly executed they were up to that moment of contact, it became abundantly clear why that happened to us. And it was not due to anybody not paying attention. Granted, you can look and Monday morning quarterback and say, well, if you did this, if you did that, well, of course. But if you knew the situation, how that whole sequence of events took place, it would be very, very clear to you how that could have possibly happened. The chances of it happening again are about net zero. I mean, sometime when you have time, I'll go through the story with you. And when you leave, you'll say, oh, my God, I can't believe all that happened. What that did was we went back, and it wasn't the finger of blame of, you know, Manuel, what are you doing running in the car? And you know, Yan, how come you're not looking in your mirror? And Danny, what were you thinking? And guys up top, what was he coming in at the same time? You can do that, but that's not what caused the issue. And that's not productive. What is productive is going back, look at what we had in place to prevent that from happening, and figure out what next level we need to prevent it from ever happening again, even though the chances of that occurring are about one in a billion. So it you know, initially it's just shattering to have that happen. But in the long view, everybody comes away thinking, you know what, we're that much better. So if you can cast it in that light, which we do, and it's no effort to do that. I mean, we've screwed up before, and we know how we deal with it. So it's just made us stronger.
And that answer is symptomatic of the way that you deal with things too, which I like a lot. You've been around this game a very long time, probably longer than you would care for me to mention in numbers of years.
Thank you.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, let's go back to... You did some racing of your own back in the 60s, in a GM product.
Yes, as a matter of fact, in a Chevelle.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. 1967, 68, and 69. Yeah.
And then after a little absence away, you came back, and there was more GM involvement with.
Yep, there was a time frame in there when I actually worked for a division of Stanley Works called Mack Tools.
Yes.
I was a director of racing for Mack Tools for several years. And through that association, formed a relationship with the Ford Motor Company and Special Vehicle Operations, headed up by Michael Kranefuss at that point in time. And from there, got recruited by Herb Fischel at GM to come and help him out with his Chevrolet road racing projects.
Okay, because you also, I mean, you did Trans Am with Tom Kendall.
Yes, that
so
was...
Olivier Beretta isn't your first one, because Tom Kendall had a Beretta.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes. You bet. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, apart from the Ford involvement, which you just talked about, is GM as a company important to you?
Oh, I don't think there's any question of that. I mean, you know... In order to be successful in my position, you really have to be a salesperson, right? That's a main portion of the job is selling things, selling the program to management, selling program to the corporation, selling programs to sponsors, and selling program to the sanctioning body. Somebody has to do that, okay? I'm the guy who wears that hat in this program. I have found that it's much easier to sell something in which you totally believe and for which you have a passion, than it is just to put on a hat, walk in the door, and try and sell something that you really know little about, that you don't really care about, that just happens to be a product. All right? Okay. People in the buying position can see through that. I think what we've always tried to deliver as a team, not just myself, but as a team, is selling ourselves because we believe in ourselves and we have a passion for what we do.
Okay. And is that passion to you personally... mean Corvette over any other particular brand?
Well, absolutely. Only a fool would say no.
Sure. Well, sure.
but I can be honest and truthful with you. Yeah. My very first brand new car, okay, was a 1971 Z28 Camaro,
okay,
which I wrecked three times in the course of 7 months, sold it, and bought my very first Corvette, which was in 1972.
Okay.
So, I think that pretty much answers the question. At that point in time, I could have bought any make, any model. Well, not any, but I mean, you know, within my price range. I chose Chevrolet because they had the coolest stuff.
So clearly there's a passion behind all this as well as a well-thought-out plan.
Oh, yes. No question about it. Yeah, you couldn't pay somebody enough to do my job if they didn't have the passion for it, because it's 24/7. You got to love what you do to be successful in this business.
Sure.
Otherwise, you're simply not going to last because the business pressures, the personal commitment that you have to make to do a proper job, and whether it's in the broadcast business, whether it's in the print business, whether it's in the PR end of the business, whether it's in the mechanical side of the business, or whether it's the marketing side, it is nonstop. You have to have that passion. You have to have that commitment if you're going to succeed at the highest levels.
So is there a case where you could allow your heart to rule your head in decision making, or because of the commercial nature of racing, does it have to be a decision taken from the head but backed up by the heart?
Well, but I think we have to divide. On a personal note, I can allow my heart to rule my head.
Okay.
From a business perspective, you'd be a fool to do that. You have to do your homework. You have to have your data. You have to put together a business case because it's going to be scrutinized by business minds. That's the foundation. I mean, the block that is laid from which you build a race program is business.
Yeah.
If there isn't a foundational business reason, a strong foundational business reason, in GM's case called our return on investment, which you've heard me talk about, then you're not going to go forward with it and you won't succeed.
Okay.
So, yes, it's both sides.
Corvette is rightly known as America's sports car, so I'm guessing that they could probably sell every unit they produce. So is there still a good economic reason for GM to take Corvette Racing in these rather difficult times?
Actually, more so in these difficult times. Marketing and advertising are great in fat times. Okay, because you're really not sure what works, what doesn't work, but you know you've got enough to do it, and you know whatever it is you're doing works, so there's no need to pull an element out of that and risk that being the important spoke of the wheel.
Yeah.
However, when times get lean, as they have been certainly globally over the last 24 to 36 months, and especially at General Motors, what we've come through economically and financially, we received the highest level of scrutiny from the brightest financial minds in the world. And if GM, say, had 8 or 9 race programs before our bankruptcy challenge, right, we now have 2,
right.
NASCAR and Corvette. There is a reason. And it wasn't because necessarily the guys who ran the company liked it or thought it was cool or they loved Corvette.
Yeah.
It was because the actuaries, the banks, the financial people, the government people, and GM management gave a strident look at where we were on return on investment and what the value that those programs brought back to the corporation in measurable quantities.
Okay.
And NASCAR and Corvette delivered back to that business foundational sense.
Yeah.
By doing our homework and building a strong business foundation, we survived in through the most difficult of times.
So with GM now hopefully on the road to recovery as a manufacturing company,
yes,
does that possibly open the door to other brands within the group going back into motorsport again? I mean, we've seen how other prestige brands, you know, BMW, mm-hmm, Ferrari, Porsche, so on, are very aware of the value of sport, mm-hmm, on their commercial side.
Yes.
Within GM, I mean, Cadillac have been racing before at this level.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be daft to see possibility of another Cadillac program?
Well, you know, not unlike ourselves, utilizing the Sebring incident as an example, okay, where we learned from a difficult and challenging situation. GM as a corporation has learned a tremendous amount about themselves through its most difficult and challenging situation. And if nothing else, they've learned through the scrutiny how these programs deliver back to the corporation and the value that they have. I think they would be very foolish and not at all responsible if they didn't look at that and think about how that might be applied in the future to other brands. Now, we're a very streamlined company.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have the number of brands that we used to have, which makes those decisions a little bit easier.
Sure.
Okay? But in dealing with the brand, what the focus would be for that brand, what their target market is, I'm sure that upper management is looking at every product we make and seeing if there isn't some application that would bring value back to the company. If they decide that there's value out there based on what they learned through our economic issues, I would not be surprised at all to see that happen.
Okay. So the marketing value, if we go back to the old saying, win on Sunday, race on Monday, mm-hmm, race on Sunday and win on Sunday, mm-hmm, and then sell on Monday,
mm-hmm,
the tough truth is that for the last 12 months and a little over now, since you jumped into the shark-infested waters of GT2,
mm-hmm,
because GT1,
right,
went the way of all flesh,
right,
it's been tough times.
you know, when I started this program and had to sell it to management, victories are fundamental. I mean, they're a fundamental element of any racing equation. But my mantra was, racing is way more than a checkered flag and a trophy. You have to get past that. If you're going to get true value out of the program, there has to be more to it. Which then begs the question, well, what are you talking about? Okay? In Corvette's case, and part of the reason that we were able to succeed through those challenging times, was a three-legged stool. Number one was marketing, the easiest way to reach our Corvette customer. I mean, that's pretty much common sense. You don't need to do a lot of math there. All right. Secondarily was technology transfer. Okay, and by that I mean what we learn on the racetrack in relatively short order at relatively expedient economics, not a lot of money, and quickly going back in to make a better production car and not limiting that just to the Corvette brand. Some of the things we have learned here are applicable to all General Motors products, all the Chevrolet products, all the Buick products, all the GMC products, all the Cadillac products. It filters its way back in. Those are real, they're measurable, and that's what the people in management saw. And the third leg of that stool is education. And that, by that I mean when we look at what we're doing with Corvette running cellulosic E85. Okay? We started that. We were the first ones to take the plunge, the first one to take the risk. Conference. But at the same time, keep in mind, at that point in time, and still to this day, GM has more flex fuel vehicles, dual gas and E85, on the road around the world, over 5 million of them, more than any other manufacturer. It helps demonstrate and educate people that there are going to be new ways in which cars are driven down the highway. Whether it be in the fuel that they use or in the propulsion systems, much like the Volt, okay, electric car. I mean, those are major breakthroughs. Now, do we think any of those one things are the answer? No, but they are part of a solution. And Corvette has gone a long way to help educate people. People tend to be culturally afraid of what they don't know, all right? So consequently, there's going to be some aversion to changing what we've done for 100 years using gasoline. So now we're using ethanol. Well, guess what? Somebody's got to lead the way with that. Can you think of a better way than going and winning races on cellulosic E85? Sure. Mom and Dad see that. Dad says, hey, I can put that in the pickup truck, drive to work. Mom says, you know what? I'm not afraid to put that in my SUV and take the kids to school. That's the educational process. So, yes, marketing, education, technology transfer. Those are real, they're measurable, and we do that at Corvette.
Do you see GM taking the next step, which we're seeing demonstrated here this weekend by Porsche, in bringing along a hybrid competition car?
From my perspective, at this point in time, I'm not aware of anything being conceived that would follow that breadth and scope. I can tell you, in the meetings that I attend on a global basis, whether they be with the ACO or with the FIA, I'm on the FIA GT. Technical working group, from a manufacturer's standpoint, right now, they're very interested in keeping racing pretty much as is, but not adverse to setting up a separate series, if you will, and I'm using that term very loosely, where you could then showcase hybrid technology, much like Porsche is doing here. Now, they're not racing against us. It's essentially a demonstration of the car's capability. And I think that's a great idea. If more manufacturers have an interest and are coming to market with those type of vehicles, I think the natural extension of that would be to have them compete in whatever it is that they choose to compete, where it would be an all-hybrid kind of series. And I know that manufacturers are looking at that, and I know that sanctioning bodies are looking at that. You'd be silly if you didn't give it consideration, but there are no, as far as I know, no immediate plans for us to go down that road.
Just to take you back to the first part of your answer there about sitting on the technical commission and coming up to the decision that for the moment the best idea about GT racing is to change very little. Mm-hmm. That is going to send a huge sigh of relief through every media center that I sit in, where conversations are being held constantly about what should we do to change GT racing? Yeah. And the answer is absolutely nothing. Leave it alone.
if we look just here in the U.S. and we look at the number of manufacturers who are competing in a common category, in my career we have never had this varied a group, this number of group, or this close of racing. This is as good as it has ever been in my history with GT racing. it's not broken, let's not try and fix it. That's not to say that there won't be a natural transition, there won't be a natural progression. Of course, that's how racing has worked, ebbed and flowed and changed and moved. But for right now, with where we are economically in the world, and where we are competitively on the racetrack, it's a perfect storm. I mean, we're providing some great racing.
Now, this might be a question allied to the sort of economic tone that's underlaid the last few questions. ILMC, the Intercontinental Le Mans Cup, is with us this weekend.
Yes.
It's already started at Silverstone in the UK. With us at Road Atlanta, going on to China. If the money were available, do you feel that sort of world stage is the kind of place that Corvette Racing would like to be?
I think the International Cup is exactly what I referred to only a moment ago. The natural ebb and flow, the natural transition, the natural tide turning. Chevrolet is a global brand, as is Cadillac. And we market those vehicles not in every country in the world, but throughout many countries in the world. None of that's wasted on the fact that in all but one or two of those markets in which that series is currently racing, we sell cars. So has it piqued our interest? Of course. We'd be foolish not to look at it. China goes without saying. I mean, Buick is a huge brand in China, by the way. I think they're the number one selling car there. I think we now sell more cars in China than we sell in the United States. It's very, very close, but that will be the case for everybody, because that's where all the people are, quite frankly, and that's the country, as it emerges, that has the largest growth potential. So we'd be very silly if we weren't looking at that. There are no immediate plans to do that, but we have talked from its inception with the ACO on the value of that. We have GT cars for sale at the current time. Ideally, in the short term, we would find a European-based customer that would be interested in campaigning in that series, for which we could sell a vehicle to and then help provide some technical assistance. If you look over the last several years since we began selling vehicles, and you look at the championships that Corvette has garnered around the world in a wide variety of series, they have done that through privateers with a little bit of help from us. And I don't mean economic help. I mean simply technical help and helping guide them and lending them people and providing drivers and other things that we've done. That's a great formula for success, and it is emblematic of a lean, well-organized corporation who's figured out a way to emerge into those markets and do it in a financially responsible way.
Does that suggestion of customer teams put an even greater pressure on you to win races here as the factory team?
You know, ordinarily you would think that because, you know, again, racing's more than a checker flag and a trophy. Guys who are in this business looked at what we did at Le Mans, okay, and they saw how well the car performed. They look at our recent history. We just didn't get dumb overnight, okay? I mean, that although we've not had what we normally would consider to be a wildly successful season, people in this industry don't look at it that we're on the downside of any curve. They're just waiting for the next shoe to drop, and that's the way the competitors are. So, no, has this... I guess the final distillation of that question would be, has your lack of a victory this season hurt the opportunity to sell new cars? No. No, it has not. People recognize where we are competitively. They recognize what the potential is. They know what we've done in the past. They've talked to people who have purchased our cars before. We know how we support our customer teams. So we're in fine shape. That's not to diminish the hurt and the pain of not having a couple of victories. Trust me, dude, we want it, and we want it very bad. But from a business perspective, it has not been detrimental.
You've said in the past that you kind of see a pie chart, if you like, of how a team wins, mm-hmm. to be 25% down to the team, 25% to the car, mm-hmm. and 50% to luck.
That's correct.
Has your
refer to it as good fortune.
Good fortune, okay. Has your venture into GT2 caused you to look at those numbers and shuffle them at all?
Actually, no. I think, quite frankly, we were the living proof. I mean, that pretty much, to me, solidified my position. Because that's exactly what it is. If you go back and you look at the data, which we do, for every vehicle on every lap of every race, and you look at fast laps, fastest 10 laps, fastest segment times, all those things, the car is there. All right? Okay. The team is there. It has simply been a question of a Petit Le Mans here last year. I mean, we were ready to dominate that race. We had just made the pit stop before the rain. So we were in fourth and fifth spot. That was no means indicative of where we were on a competitive basis. That's just the luck of the draw. Le Mans were leading. There's no other competition left. Yeah. You know, we get an unfortunate set of circumstances arise, and we're knocked out of that race. I mean, you only have to look at the last three or four races in which we've entered. It's just been a series of things, and that's the way it works. We have a number of victories to our credit that we were awarded by good fortune.
Yes.
Okay?
Sure.
And I can think of a couple of Le Mans wins that came our way based on good fortune. Bad fortune for somebody else, good fortune for us.
Yeah.
And that's the way this year has been.
Okay.
So, no, it's still and verified. Signed, sealed, stamped, delivered, 25% great car, 25% great team, 50% good fortune. You got to have that. You can have the fastest car, the best drivers, and the greatest team. You get hit by a back marker or by an over-anxious LMP car, guess what? You're done.
For the benefit of the listening audience, there was a very throwaway shrug there. You're done. It's very philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you personally deal with it? Is that the only way that you can?
You have to. You have to. You have. If you carry that baggage with you, I can tell you, it's not long before everybody on that team begins to take on that same mentality. You lead by example, okay? And if I'm flying off the handle all the time, yelling and screaming, running down, pointing my finger in the face of officials, if I'm doing all that, they see that. And it's just like raising a family. Then I've okayed that. That means that's how we roll, and that's not how we roll. You lead by example here, and that means you put it behind you, you roll up your sleeves. The greatest line in my racing career came from Alain Berthaud at the ACO after our first year and our struggling to try and beat the Vipers with that huge, 8-liter
truck engine.
Honest to God. Every time we'd go a little bit faster, they'd go faster. They had plenty, way more than they were showing. And it was so frustrating to all of us. And I had a meeting with Alain. And I said, Alain, can we do something to performance balance this? I said, I need some help to be competitive. The program's in its infancy. We've got to show some signs of progress. Every time we go faster, they go faster. I said, is there something? Can you help us out? He said, yes, I can. He says, I can help you out, Doug. He says, here's what I can do for you. I'm going to tell you, go home, work harder. I said, thought about it for a minute. I said, Alain, thank you. I appreciate those words. I went home and I told our guys, here's what we got, guys. Some words of advice. Work harder.
Yeah.
That was resolute.
Yeah.
They got together. That served as our launching point of saying, okay, fine. That's what we're going to do. And that's what we've continued to do.
So if everybody up to that point thought they were giving of their best already, how do you lift them to that next level again? This is sort of Vince Lombardi mm-hmm. stuff, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, exactly. You only have to look around. If somebody else can do it, there's no reason we can't. You have to make them believe that they can. If you can do that, they can do that. And they got to know that you have their back, that they have your undying support. And that's been the case all around. If we've screwed something up and somebody's down on us, if we have a rules, there's been a couple times when we've gone in, car's been overweight, we've been taken down. I've got to go down and talk to the officials. They know that I'm going to go and support them in whatever it is. I'm going to come to their defense. I'm going to explain to them how it happened, what's going on. They believe in that. If you can get them to believe in that, and you can get them to believe in themselves, it works. And right now, obviously, with the success that we've had, I mean, that's a big chunk of that's done.
Sure. Sure.
All right. There's not a guy standing out there that doesn't think we can't win here. I mean, we just didn't show up to run around and go to the banquet.
No.
I mean, we're here, and as we are in every race, because we think we can win. And we want to win every race. And when we don't, there is disappointment. We don't walk away happy. We don't walk away disappointed from the standpoint of dob or down. We walk away more challenged, knowing we got to go back and following Alain Berthaud's guidance. We need to work harder, guys. We need to do better.
So to lead by that example, mm-hmm. as you do, you must have a huge amount of self-discipline too. I mean, in your own life, how do you keep yourself going to that level? What do you do on a day-to-day level to actually make that happen?
I get asked that question a lot, and it's caused some introspection on my part to figure out what it is. It's simply the passion to succeed, number one, and over time, the love that you've developed for the people with whom you work and knowing how important it is to them. Yeah. These are people that I have been associated with in some cases for over 22 years. I've watched them from being young people grow up into being family people. Their kids are now here. Their kids are now performing work on this car. That builds a passion in you that you simply can't buy. And so that's what does it. I love the people with whom I work. I enjoy the sport. I love the thrill of competition. I revel in our success because I can see the looks on their faces when they succeed. And taking them to someplace they never thought they could go. Okay. If you ask any one of them, they would have never dreamed that they'd ever be flying across the ocean just to compete at Le Mans, let alone to win. And once they achieve that, they want more. They realize how good that feels and how important that is. And everybody likes to be part of something that's important and recognized. That's simply human nature. So if you can create that environment, and that's simply where I'm at.
Sure.
I'm in an environment that challenges me and that rewards me. And that's what keeps me passionate and that's what keeps me motivated.
Do you allow yourself any time off, any play time?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, on a personal note, I spend a lot of time cycling,
yeah.
and not as near as much time as I would like golfing. But cycling has been my newest greatest thing. It serves a dual purpose. Number one, it allows me to vent whatever frustrations I may build up during the course of a day, a week, or a month, or a year. and secondly, as part of a fitness regimen, I become more mature in my position to maintain energy levels in order to continue to try and keep us
yeah.
running the top.
Yeah.
You've got to be on top of your game. You've got to be fit. You've got to be ready to go. And so it helps me with that. Years ago, I really didn't need that. Now, you know, it's even I get a little bit tired on certain days. Not often.
Sure.
But it can wear you out. So that's what I do. Cycling and golf. I do a lot of reading. I enjoy reading periodicals.
Okay.
I do some books when I travel, but mostly newspapers, magazines, that sort of thing.
Okay.
I'm interested in what goes on in the world in a wide variety of different areas. So I enjoy that. That's pretty much what I do to relax. I make sure I read the entire paper every day at some point in time. And then I try and get in either a swim workout or you see me on my bike around the racetrack, you know, that sort of thing. And then a little gym work as well. So that works out very, very well for me.
Cool. I mean, it's tough work on everybody in the team, drivers included. And in last round, we've seen a little shuffle around in the mm-hmm. driver lineup.
Mm-hmm.
What was the thinking behind that?
Well, you know, when we looked we only have to look at a qualification sheet and look at the times. And you've got a group of six or eight cars, any one of which is fully capable of winning the race. Fully capable. All right. And you see that just literally the hundredths of a second that separate those cars. As I said before, we collect a huge amount of data, and we were going back in there. And anytime you have two guys or three guys driving a car, the car becomes a compromise.
Yeah.
All right, between the two. And you look at leaning one way or the other. You know, what we were finding was if we leaned too far towards one-way setup, the other guy found it increasingly more difficult to drive the car. So we looked at what the driving character over the course of this year. We were looking at the driving characteristics of the handling characteristics that each driver preferred. And as we got more information on the new car and engine package, it became clear that Johnny and Oliver, or Johnny and Olivier, were more closely aligned in what they liked in the handling characteristic of the car, as were Jan and Oliver.
Yeah.
Well, what that does is, it may, you might take a skosh off the top level of the car by doing that. But what you've done in the predominant area under the curve is made both cars way more competitive against the field. And that's what we did. And if you look at the data at Mosport, where we made that change, both cars were highly competitive all the time they were on the racetrack, as opposed to one guy getting in, not being that competitive, and having to wait for the other guy to get in who could maximize the setup.
Sure.
We were able to maximize the setup on both cars by changing drivers, and at any point in time, either one of those cars were the fastest car on the racetrack, which we hadn't been able to achieve the other way. Just unique to this car because it's so sensitive to setup. There's not near as much downforce on this car, and so it becomes... It's a lot more in the setup. With a lot of downforce, you can overcome differences and likes because you can depend on the downforce to carry it through. We don't have that here. So the personal likes and dislikes are magnified by that lack of downforce.
Okay, so with the third drivers coming in to each car here with Manu and Antonio, did you sort of kind of go through that process as well when you assigned them?
Not to the highest level, only because when you look here, this is a race in which you're fully capable of doing with two drivers.
Okay.
All right? And that's not to diminish the importance of Manu and Antonio, because they are valued members. But in all likelihood, depending on what the weather would be, we can tailor time in the car. And both those guys have enough experience in the car and are good enough. And the reason they're here is because those two guys have an amazing skill set. I mean, we went through a lot of guys. They can drive anything you put them in. In other words, that differentiation between setup is minimized when they're behind the wheel. Because they're used to, over in Europe, I mean, they're driving 100 different things.
Yeah.
And they just, you know, they don't, there's no mind games with them. They're not at all opposed to it. They've grown up with it. They're totally accustomed to it.
Yeah.
And they acclimate themselves much more quickly and much more effortlessly than our guys who are driving it every single day that know every little nuance. I mean, these guys know what we can get out of it. They don't know.
Yeah.
So that actually works to our benefit. So it didn't, they were kept in the car simply because of fit. It's easier for them. And they're happy with that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Being accustomed to the same driver roster pretty much for a long while now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's only when sort of Ron Fellows left that you had any change since the Max Pappas days. And
right.
It's been a long while.
Yes.
Have you any new talent on the horizon? Are you? Is this a constant search? Are you always on the lookout?
Well, you know, interestingly enough, I wouldn't say it's a search or a lookout. Our phone rings on a regular basis with people wanting to stop in. Not necessarily leave.
Yeah.
Okay? What we have done since the program's inception, there is no one that's locked into any single thing here, yours truly included. We evaluate where we are. We evaluate what was accomplished. We evaluate where we're going. And we also look at and pay a huge amount of attention to the personal goals and objectives of each driver.
Okay.
Which, if you recall, we had brought Marcel on. And he had done some Corvette driving for us over in Europe. And he was a happy camper and loved us. He loved being here. He had an opportunity very, very late in the game at the beginning of this year when Audi came back to him and said, we'd like you to drive the R car at Le Mans.
Yeah.
And so he came. Now, mind you, he didn't have to ask because we were in the process of renewing contracts. He could have just said, guess what, I'm going.
Yeah.
But he asked. He said, here's the opportunity I have. I said to him, Marcel, you can't turn that down. You can't. You got to go do that. You got to go do that. So he went and he did that. What that did was kind of catch us out, because now at the very last minute, we're thinking, holy, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
Well, fortunately, because we had had Manu in our program before with the Cadillac, and who, by the way, we at that same time we had him in the Corvette as well, was familiar with the car, so we could plug him in.
Yeah.
What that caused us then to do was to think, what would we ever do if, you know, somebody got hurt, the lawnmower ran over their foot, they got sick, where would we go?
Yeah.
There was no one else out there. I mean, you could go back to some of your old guys. You go back to Kelly Collins or an Andy Pilgrim or Ron Fellows, which, you know, we would not be adverse to doing. But we thought we might better find some guys, you know, and get them. So it's a Mark Goossens, you know, it's a Graham Rahal.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring guys in, get them familiar with the car, get them some time in it. So if we get pressed into emergency situation, we got a little farm team we can go to. That's one side of it. The other side of it is, obviously, I mean, you only have to do the math. At some point in time, as it did with Ron, okay, he realizes that he's on the downside of that curve and that he has other opportunities in his life to go do things. And you don't have to tell these guys. They know when they're a rag wiping more on than they are wiping off. There's no mystery there. And so we go back, we look at the data, we look at what improvement there might have been from year to year, and then we'll make an informed and a calculated decision as to what we do. But we do that every year.
Yeah.
And again, we have to take into consideration what other personal objectives the drivers might have, much like Marcel, if they have better opportunities. So are we adverse to change? No, we're not. Do we insist on change? No, we don't. Are changes going to be made throughout the life of this program? There have always been changes, and there will continue to be changes.
Okay.
But we don't put a time frame in it. We don't have any immediate plans. Again, it'll all be evaluated at the end, and we'll make a decision then.
Yeah. So that's how things stand as of now.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming to the end of one season. There'll be a brief off-season, which I guess for you is no rest at all. Because
none. No, we'll be, I'm not certain, but I think we do have something set up at the end of October. We'll be right back on the racetrack. We have so much to learn about this car and this engine, and we've got a lot of neat stuff that we want to try and plug in. We've set a goal for ourselves. I think we need to be, we know what percentage better we have to be next year.
Okay.
The new Ferrari's coming, which is wider. We know it's already fastest car on the racetrack. We know how much faster it's going to be next year with the new car. So we've got our work cut out for us. Because we know Porsche and BMW and Jaguar and Ford are not going to be sitting back thinking, well, we'll just play this pat hand next year.
Yeah.
They're going to be doing the same thing we're doing.
Okay, so you've told me already that you don't see ILMC as a viable option right away.
For us.
Right away.
I can tell you that in 2011, as a factory team, we will not be competing. Other than the races that are in the U.S.,
sure,
Sebring.
Sure.
No, we will not.
So it's another ALMS program.
It's another ALMS program. You betcha.
With the C6.
Two cars, same deal.
Cool.
Yep.
Excellent. Doug Feehan, it's been an absolute pleasure, as it always is. I've taken up way more time, much more of your time than I said I would. Thank you for staying with us, and thank you for staying with Corvette.
Well, I enjoy it, and I want to thank all our fans for sticking with us, too, and I want to thank the ALMS for doing yet again another wonderful job bringing the best road racing in the world to American and North American and over in Le Mans. It's just been a great ride for us, and we're hoping to provide our fans with a little more enjoyment in 2011 than we did in 2010, although they had a hell of a good time.
This program is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemans.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.